You are now entering the spoiler zone. The following podcast contains explicit plot details and pockets of profanity. You have been warned. The Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in wine and space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss. Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And tonight we're watching The Tomorrow People, The Vanishing Earth. Alien criminal Spidron is mining the Earth's core for rare minerals, leading to a serious geological planet-wide instability that may shatter the planet. Ginge, while holidaying at the seaside, is captured when visiting the haunted house at a funfair and ends up working on the Spidron's control to mine the precious minerals. Lefty seeks out the Tomorrow People to locate their friend, and for the first time, the Tomorrow People encounter the Galactic Federation, a network of fellow telepaths from different species that have banded together to protect the galactic peace and prevent the exploitation of more vulnerable species. Dr. Exton, there is a reason why we've picked this.
There is, and it is in memoriam of the actor Peter Vaughan Clark, who played the regular character of Stephen Jameson in the early years of The Tomorrow People. He was really front and centre right from episode one. So the first story, The Slaves of Jedediah, was all about his breaking out, becoming a Tomorrow person, and the struggles that he had dealing with that and integrating with the established group of Tomorrow People, which at that point were John, Carol, and Kenny. And he was right front and centre in that and became more diluted as the series went on and ended up being replaced by Mike Bell.
Oh, well, a real step up there for the character. Well, to give a little bit of a bio, Peter Vaughan Clark was born in 1957. He was active as an actor from 1972, and he's best known as Stephen from Tomorrow People, which he later came back to for the audio series by Big Finish. He's also appeared
in
the...
Have you heard them?
Yes, I have, actually. I've actually finally heard some of these, and they're really good.
They're brilliant. Have you heard Stephen's story arc in it?
No, but then I've not got all of them. I've just got a handful that you've lent to me. This is something we obviously need to come back to because it's one of the ranges of Big Finish that you've really sung the praises of. What else has he been? He's been in The Palliser on TV, Shoestring, Duchess of Jew Street, and he was also in some 1975 British film, It Could Happen to You, a.k.a. Intimate Teenage Secrets, along with his Tomorrow People co-star Nicholas Young. After retiring from acting in 1980, he worked as a lighting technician and a key grip, and he died in August 2023 at the tender age of 66, which is no age at all these days.
Yeah.
I've had a brief look. There's not an awful lot obituary-wise online, and I would have thought the Tomorrow People community would have been a little bit more illuminated by it, but I am quite saddened to find, and I'd never thought it before, that he's referred to in Tomorrow People circles as PVC. So we're going to watch all four episodes of A Tomorrow People story that he was in. It's the final story from season one. But before then, it's time for a little trip into the bowels of Podcasting House. And we're going to open up one of the doors. Dr. Exton, which one are you going for?
To be honest, I think there's only one that we can go for because he's a bit young to have any missing television. So the obvious thing is the gift shop.
Sunshine, lollipops and rainbows, everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together.
What are you pulling out for us?
Well, Big Finish, one of the best things that they've ever done is their Tomorrow People series. And the character of Stephen is brilliantly done. I mean, on the television series, as with all of them, he was a bit two-dimensional. He's well played, but he wasn't particularly well written. He has a brilliant brilliant story arc in Big Finish. Not the biggest. The ones that come back and really make a big deal in the Big Finish productions are John Harrell and...
Sue Tai?
Funnily enough, no. Oh, and Mike.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they're really the three, but you do get to see a lot of the other surviving characters.
Didn't you say that a handful get killed off in the first scene of the very first episode or something?
Two, Kenny and Sue Tai, because they were both dreadful. neither had anything on their acting resumes, and I suspect just weren't interested in coming back. Kenny kind of fell into it by accident because of a youth club he was in, and Sue Tai was married to a producer or something. But neither of them were or went on to become professional actors. And I suspect if they were approached, would have just been, yeah, that was shit I did 40 years ago. I'm not coming back to it. So.
In preparation for this, I've done a bit of research on the Tomorrow People audio series. I know that at least half of the sixth series was recorded and produced before Big Finish lost the license. And it's a real shame, actually, they've never got it back. Now, whether or not they've not tried or whether it's just not available, I don't know.
I mean, the reason behind it was the American reboot of the Tomorrow People, so they lost their license. And these licenses often have 20 years to run, so it will be whenever that runs out. My understanding is that the sixth series was completely recorded, but only three had been edited.
Come the end of series six, the plan was for Nigel Fairs to step down as producer of The Range, and Kevin Scott and Mark Wright were going to take over for series 7 and 8. From the look of it, it would have taken quite a different direction. It was due to skip forward quite a few years after Series 6 and explore the future of Homo Superior. But Paul Mars was involved in Series 7, and yeah.
So lucky escape there. Actually, to be fair, his Big Fish stuff hasn't been terrible.
I was never a big fan of his...
Well, he was the Wormery, wasn't he?
The Wormery, which I'm fond of for all the wrong reasons. The Irish Wild Time stuff I have actually enjoyed, but I think that's more because of Katie Manning and Maria McCurlum. She was an incarnation of Bianca as well, and she was extremely good.
He did Excellus, didn't he?
He started the whole thing off with Excellus Dawns, and then Excellus, that went off in a very... It was really odd, Excellus. I really wanted to like it, particularly, to be honest, the first part of that is the best. But it just didn't go anywhere, Excellus, unfortunately.
I kind of remember it as being meh.
The first two parts were good. The third part, what the hell happened there? And there is a Bernice Summerfield fourth part, which I've heard once. I think only because it came as part of the bundle that I bought it with. And I've never got into the spin-offs.
Well, those are the spin-offs that are quite nice. And it does sound as though the direction they were going to go in is what they ended up eventually doing with... Oh, what's the Chunky Gilmore?
Oh, Countermeasures.
Countermeasures, that's it. And you have their early 60s stuff while they're sort of their original type characters. And then they disappear for about 10 years and reappear in the early 70s. And it doesn't really work.
Yeah, because the way they went with Countermeasures and then new Countermeasures, it came across to me, having never heard of one, got to be honest, and it's something I really should have made an effort with. It came across as trying to do Avengers, New Avengers with their own series. But I think part of the appeal of New Avengers at the time would have been, oh, it's been 7-8 years since the last series, let's give this a go and see what they've done with it. Whereas going from one series to new Countermeasures within the space of what? It'll have only been a matter of months. You're not going to get that.
I think it was a couple of years.
Was it?
I think there was a significant gap. Maybe not a couple of years, but it was certainly a year.
Yeah, is it long enough to miss it? But anyway, do you think we've wandered off far enough? Do you think we should get back to the viewing room?
Yes, because you're actually going to have a treat by watching one of the good Tomorrow People stories.
You say this every time. Come on, let's slam the door and find out.
I don't think there's one that we've watched so far that I've described as good. There's lots I've described as entertaining. It's not the same thing.
In fairness, The Dirtiest Business was genuinely quite good.
And also, not my choice. That was Si taking pity on you and letting you watch one of the good ones, whereas I take delight in you watch the crap, such as Living Skins.
Living Skins was, it was certainly a thing, wasn't it?
And were you entertained by it?
I was entertained by it, yes, but I've been in bunny ears entertained by every Tomorrow People that we've watched. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were good. But you have always said that the earlier ones, in fact, the first three series, I think you said, were of a higher quality than what came afterwards.
Yeah, although Man for Emily comes in the first three series, so you don't have everything. And actually, the most entertaining that I've had from watching Tomorrow People is the look on your face when you first realised it was Peter Davison in that costume.
Well, anyway, tonight we are watching The Vanishing Earth. It's a four-part story from 1973, and it's the last story from season one with the usual trepidation, Run VT.
Have you calculated the increase in the frequency yet, Tim?
Yes, I have just got the figures in. Up to noon yesterday, the percentage increased is 756.7.
Over what period?
The last 12 months set against the previous 12 months.
We've got to tell the Sapstone, we've just got to! We can't just sit back and let the Earth be destroyed. It's going against our every principle.
Well, they must be aware of it as we are.
Of course they are. They have a great deal of information, but not enough knowledge to use it. Don't forget that our methods and calculations are well in advance of theirs.
I've marked the areas where we hope to get readings. I want you and Kenny to cross-reference them with those we made yesterday in Siberia, okay?
Yeah, fed up with always being left behind.
They also serve who only stand and wait.
Very funny.
We won't be long.
Well, the production values for this are terrible. Oh, they're properly bad for anyone that's ever had a pop at Doctor Who. And it was the fashionable thing to do for quite a while. It's never been anything like this bad. I'm going to get that out of the way, then we can stop taking the piss. But it was wibbly-wobbly sets, as much CSO as they could possibly get away with.
And terrible CSO.
Oh, terrible CSO. And lots and lots and lots of very bad stock footage covered in hairs in the gate and scratches and grain and God knows what else. I'm getting that out of the way because it's unfair having to said, focus on that.
And having said that, there's a lot of location filming around Clacton and that looks pretty good. The haunted house sequence, and okay, they're very proud of it and they put it in several times, and that bit with the flashing eyes and the skull on the spider web and stuff, I thought was really well done.
It was, and that was one of the things I've got in my notes. That sequence is actually quite creepy. And the general direction of this thing, who's the director? Paul Bernard.
Paul Bernard directed The Day of the Daleks, The Time Monster, Frontier in Space. He was the director on the first Tomorrow People story, The Slaves of Jedediah. He also worked as a production designer and did six of the early episodes of The Avengers, including Girl on the Trapeze with that absolutely wonderful circus set, and less wonderfully, Propellant 23 with the airport set that was the size of a postage stamp.
It was an airport of the time. They were very taxi rank in those days.
We've seen other airports of the time, haven't we? Skyport.
Yeah, which was pretty much the same set, as I recall.
But about three times the size. I mean, it was three times as dull as well. But
yes, direction-wise, I've got to say this guy was really making the most of the meagre materials he had. All fair play to you there. It did look good.
And the Spider-on lair through the haunted house kind of looked like a monochrome version of the miniscope.
Yes, that was what I had in my head as well.
With an alien hand in it that was quite reminiscent of the space prawn from The Invisible Enemy.
Oh, I just had Christmas tree in my head. Little baubles on the fingertips.
And some drones wandering around that looked like Cut Price Ambassadors of Death. There was a lot of Doctor Who stuff sort of wandering around.
It is very Doctor Who in its feel. I mean, the main baddie, Spider-on, he spends most of the story in a sort of a Perspex case, dressed like a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
And doing vaguely anemic voguing. I don't think you mean Spider-on. I think you mean Spider-on.
Yes, but why? This is what I didn't really get my head around. In the very first scene he appears in, it's pissing down inside that box, and then it's bone dry for the rest of the story, and this is never explained.
Well, it
kind
of is.
Don't try and explain it away.
Allow me to explain, or put a bit of headcanon into it. So, What's inside the box isn't the Spydron. It's a hologram projected from where Spydron is. And Spydron's hiding in a sewer. And if the sewer was a bit full of water or whatever, that could end up dropping on his head. So it wasn't necessarily rain that was coming down.
It was matter. I do love your headcanoning. He throws out some wonderful explanations. I mean, we start the action. There's a very preachy bit right at the start of the episode about, oh, basically global warming and all that, and how the saps, presumably Homo sapiens, I would think,
yes,
are fucking up the planet. And they don't care about it, and they wouldn't believe us even if we told them not to. Wah, wah, wah. Stamp,
well,
stamp.
And that was very heavy, heavy-handed, and just reminded me of a Chibnall episode.
It was, although it was still better done than a Chibnall episode.
It's kind of global warming's bad, MK.
But then we cut to two middle-aged men never seen before.
No. Before we cut away from that, we have the John and Carol conversation. And Carol is lovely, and she's obviously the heart of the group, and John is the patronising arse in charge. And not only is he a patronising arse to Carol, who is a little bit Pollyanna and... Sorry?
Screechy. She screeches as soon as she opens her mouth, and she never stops screeching the whole way through. She reminded me of Joe Grant as a doctor worst all the time. Every time she opened her mouth. Carol, would you like a cup of tea? A cup of tea? Oh, my God. How long will the kettle take to boil? How much energy is it going to use? Oh, John, can we really afford to make a cup of tea? John, oh, my.
Yeah, she was a bit earnest. And it's, oh, John, we must save the saps. We just must. So John's massively dismissive to her and mansplains the whole way through, even though she's the one doing all the working out of stuff. And then he's just a phenomenally patronising us about the whole of humanity. And, oh, it would probably be better for them not to bother knowing that they're going to die. Who died and left you in charge?
I'd love to know how old John's supposed to be. He's clearly older than the rest of them. But not that old.
The big Finnish canon is that he was the first tomorrow person to break out and survive, and that there'd been some prior to him who hadn't survived the experience, and that he'd got in touch with somebody from the Trig who'd helped him to build Tim. And John was some kind of electronics genius and had 30 million patents, which is how he could afford to buy a disused underground station and his... four-wheeled Wankmobile.
Yeah, as we saw in one episode, he's just driving around in this convertible Triumph or something. It's a very nice car, whatever it was, swaggering around in...
in sheepskin.
To be fair, John, I know it's of its time, but he's a very natty dresser.
You have been spending too long with the boys from the Peggy Mount Calamity Hour.
Anyway.
He's not a natty dresser. He dresses like a geography teacher.
Oh, in a couple of the episodes I've seen, he's... if I was a man of the time, which I'm not... Anyway, we cut to a suspiciously empty fairground that is suspiciously populated with middle-aged men. Now, all whether or not they're supposed to be middle-aged. Oh, yes, and then Joy, this Agnetha Feltskog lookalike, wandering around, flashing her arse at middle-aged men and then getting them to teleport down to be converted into slaves.
And yet another astoundingly bad actress.
Well, bear in mind, Kevin Stoney's in this thing. And John Woodnut plays that thing. The Ku Klux Klan monster. Mavic Chen doesn't speak a word until episode 3. So until that point, John Woodnut is barely recognisable because he's wearing a pillowcase on his head. The best actor in it for most of this, I've got to say, because everybody in it, it's like they've wandered into the school careers office. What do you want to do as a job? Well, why don't you try being an actor? Well, I don't want to be an actor, really. Well, give it a go. And there's nobody on screen has got the vaguest talent of any kind for being an actor, except, now what's his name here? Kenneth Farrington, who plays Smithers.
You and mean Billy Walker from Coronation Street?
Yes, and he was really quite good. But apart from Kevin Stoney, who is just Mavic Chen, and I'm afraid the first word that entered my head when he popped on screen was...
Packer?
It was. So there's him and the Farrington bloke, and it should be John Woodnut, but it could have been anybody, frankly. Everybody
else
would
now be an apposite time to do Who alumni, because there are a number.
Run the list.
Right. So Kevin Stoney was Tyrum in Revenge of the Cybermen, Tobias Vaughan in The Invasion, and Mavic Chen in Dalek Masterplan. John Woodnut was Seren in The Keeper of Trark and the Duke of Forgill in Terror of the Zygons and the Draconian Ambassador in Frontier in Space. He was also Colonel Lemming in an episode of The Corridor People.
Moving on.
Derek Crew, who plays Lefty, astoundingly badly, but he did play Lefty, was Singe in The Sunmakers. David Weston, who played number 300 behind that re-entry shield, was Birok in Warrior's Gate and Nicholas Muss in The Massacre. Stephen Salmon playing Kenny, this was his only listed role on IMDb. Try to act surprised, because I doubt he could. Peter Vaughan Clark, Stephen, was his only major role. Sammy Windmill did have a bit more of a career. She was one of the minor regulars in The Duchess of Duke Street. She appears in Up Pompeii. Her first credit was in Futtock's End. Michael Standing had been in Ace of Wands, turns up in The Champions, Adam Lives, things like that. That's about it.
You see, I'm not at all familiar with this early period of Tomorrow People. And A Man for Emily is still my earliest experience. So I hadn't got a clue as we were wandering around this fairground with middle-aged men playing children's games who Ginge and Lefty were.
They're only in the first season.
Yeah, well, you've never mentioned them. And it's a bit nebulous unless you have been watching. You don't know who they are. They are mentioned by the Tomorrow People at HQ while they're watching videos of volcanoes and floods and things. So you get the general gist that they're known to them, but not who they are. Are they Tomorrow People? Are they just people they know? What are they?
Their reason for inclusion in the script is that the Tomorrow People were unable to hurt anybody or act physically. They had some sort of mental block that meant that they were sort of had to be pacifists. And what that means is that they had to have somebody who could do action sequences, or that's what they thought. So that's why Ginge and Lefty were in there. And then they're replaced in the second season by, I think it's Ginge's cousin, Chris, who's played by Christopher Chittell. Goes on to Emmerdale.
Mm.
And then he's just phased out. I can't remember whether that character carries on through into season three, but he doesn't carry on any further than that. Well, we're still doing alumni. Would you like some Tomorrow People alumni trivia? Okay, it's not for this story. It's for the next story, The Blue and the Green.
I'm all ears.
The Blue and the Green is largely set in a school. It's where we first meet the character of Elizabeth, who's there as a supply teacher or a student teacher or something. And it's the school that Stephen goes to. But two of the other students in Stephen's class are played by Pauline Quirk and Linda Robson. It was the first time they worked together. And then, 20 years later, they did Birds of a Feather together.
Yeah, because I think them two, though, they really have been best mates all their life.
I think Tomorrow People was where they met, because I think there were a whole load of students that were sort of dragged along from a local drama school, and they were two of the students in the drama school.
And some of them were female, but not many. Yes, you, girl, keep your cardigan on, put an extra layer on. You, boy, there, down to the swimming trunks, please, and to camera. That's beautiful, gorgeous, lovely shot, darling, lovely shot.
And
we'll take that again, just get another few
and
takes.
And lights, action, teabag.
Anyway.
You are familiar with teabagging.
I'm aware of the concept, and yeah, let's not go there. There's a lot of stuff in this that you would never put in a children's programme now, such as smoking a fag and even having a bang on a shisha. As I was saying about the fairground, Ginge tries to cop off with Joy at the fairground.
Yes, punching massively.
She literally runs off and he runs after her. This is not good behaviour, boys and girls. If someone says no, take the hint. Don't literally chase them. What the hell?
I mean, he did come across as a bit of a creepy twat.
And about 20 years older than her. He was another terrible actor.
Oh, but nowhere near as bad as she was. I mean, Lefty, Kenny and Joy.
She was clearly hired for the fact that she looked like a member of ABBA, and she had a magnificent arse that they shoehorned in some tiny little shorts and showed off as often as they could. But two of the ones that stood out to me were Kenny and Stephen. Well,
Stephen?
Oh, yeah, he wasn't good.
Yeah, he was nowhere near as bad as the rest of them.
No, there was an element, but I think he was having acting lessons as he worked. Literally, just watch the other actors and see what they do. And I mean, Kenny, why was he there? He did bugger all. He was pissing about with a colouring book or something, or his maths homework, mute for most of the episode. And then at some point he's there for... They've got this wobbly seance table thing that lights up.
And a weird game on it that looks like a cross between Kaplunk and a hedgehog.
Yeah, this strategy game thing, but Kenny barely says a word. Now think about this. If you include Tim, they've got five regulars and four 20-minute episodes. What the hell are you going to do with five regulars?
Seven. Ginge and Lefty were regulars throughout the whole series.
Oh, of course, yes. So inevitably, at least one of them has got fuck all to do.
This is the story where Lefty has the most to do, because normally he just hangs around in Ginger's shadow, and he kind of comes a bit more into his own once Ginger's kidnapped. Kenny does bugger all. I mean, it's like you've got the almost a sort of Tomorrow People family, where you've got John as your dull geography teacher father, Carol being terribly mumsy and earnest, Stephen and Kenny being the scrapping, annoying teenage kids, and Tim as the creepy uncle.
Tim, I've got to say, far better when he's nailed to the ceiling rather than wandering around as a drinks trolley.
And what I did like in this was the flare effect of the jaunting. I thought that worked very well.
Yeah, I don't remember that before.
No, they phase it out fairly quickly.
Pity, because it works well. But Kenny, again, having done a little bit of digging, Kenny actually wanted to be an electrician in real life, and he was dragooned into this and left via creative differences at the end of the first series. Mm-hmm.
You're crap, fuck off.
Or, I'm not staying around in this shit, I want to piss about with wires. Either way, it was the right decision for both of them, I think.
I haven't seen any season one episodes for a while. He's worse than I remember, and I remember him being bad.
The fairground features quite a bit. It's obviously in the middle of winter. It's desolate. It looks awful. And one of the things that struck me was that Stephen gets charged 10p to go on the haunted house. Now, in 1973, 10p is quite dear. Even with those effects, it did come across as, this better be good.
Well, it's good enough for him to want to go back.
And get told, why do you want another go? Come back later. Obviously, a very, very good business strategy. You've enjoyed it so much. You want another go? I think not. Be gone with you. And then you've got Smithers.
I couldn't hear that name and not think The Simpsons.
Smithers! But Mavic Chen arrives in his office and tells him that he's under threat. And Smithers stomps around saying what he's just a perfectly ordinary bloke, mate, while he's reading a children's comic. So, Mavic Chen, or Steen. Now, that's another thing that came across. Every time everyone talks to Steen, they say his name. Every single time. Steen? Is that what you're saying? I know, Steen. Steen! Oh my, look, Steen over there! He's not going to forget what his own name is, that's for damn sure.
But before we get the introduction of Steen, because he doesn't really come into his own until the beginning of episode 3 after Stephen's been chucked off the pier, the bit where Joy and the hypnotised people are chasing Stephen through the Spydron lair out the back of the haunted house, one, there were some really nice sort of flare lighting effects on that, but there were throughout the whole of the haunted house. But the fact that they had that sort of fairground Wurlitzer music in the background worked really nicely as a counterpoint.
As I've said earlier, I am not going to criticise the direction of a thing. I think that it's
been... No, because it was good.
It was. It really was. Considering the very poor materials that the director had to work with,
I think
set-wise and actor-wise. Oh, come on. They were clearly making this on a shoestring. It clearly shouldn't have looked anywhere near as good as it did. I've got to give it credit.
But you can say that about the early Doctor Who's, and they were made with imagination spit and newspaper.
Yeah, I know, but I think there's a certain amount of over-ambition with the Tomorrow People.
And this looked cheaper, although there were a couple of really nice sets. I mean, obviously they spent money on the Tomorrow People HQ because it was going to be across all of the series. But when they come on to the second lair in the sewers at Kingston and all that...
Umska.
No, I was going to say all that messing about on that boat and the explosion and everything, then that looked pretty good.
No, I'm not picking too big a hole in it. It's early 70s, if not science fiction, then certainly fantasy. And they were really stretching this as far as credibility would allow. I have not got to the, as you put it, the wanking dustbins yet. I've seen aliens in Tomorrow People, and they're not good. They at least didn't try and remove Spydron's hat and show us the horrific monster underneath, because I don't think they really could have done that justice.
Because it would have been Nigel Farage.
I'm not letting you go down this route. Anyway, we do get a mention of the mind probe.
We did. I've written my notes with that, with exclamation points afterwards.
No, it's the mind probe. It also amused me that Mavic Chen, he's also found another rarest element in the universe. He's already got terranium. Now he's got magnanite or manganite or whatever it is.
Mango.
The rarest element in the universe, Packer.
And I have to say, I thought some of the cliffhangers were pretty good.
Yes, they were.
Episode 2, I can't remember what the cliffhanger was to episode 1, but episode 2, chucking Stephen off the pier and looking as though he was drowning, that was pretty good.
Well, the cliffhanger to episode 1 was Ginge being confronted by the Spydron, and to be fair, again, it was well done.
And the cliffhanger to episode 3 was fantastic. Really set you up for episode 4.
General alarm! General alarm! All personnel will take cover! All personnel will take cover!
Dean and the rest of the telepaths will simply jaunt out of here.
But they won't, will they, my dear? Instead, they'll stay with them, trying to save them right to the end. And
in the end, they'll perish with them. It's lava! Steam, it's lava!
That bit at the end of episode 3 and the beginning of episode 4 where they're running about in that underground mining base and all those sweaty men in singlets. Touch the homoerotics there. It did...
Was this a running theme?
It did sound as though it should have had a Frankie Goes to Hollywood score in the background.
There weren't actually that many gaffes in this. I mentioned about the wobbly seance table that they've got at HQ. Every time John bumps into it, it looks like it's going to collapse.
Oh, and Kenny spends the whole day doing all these complex calculations for John on this table. And it seems to be about the only thing that he does. And he and Stephen are doing some, and Stephen's got a calculator the size of a breeze block. And Kenny's faffing about with a pair of dividers. But he's got all of these calculations laid out on this bit of paper. And the moment John turns up, he just picks them all up and dumps them on the floor.
We've got to find something for this kid to do. Maths homework? Yes. But the only other genuine cock-up I could find in this thing, when Steen turns up and warns Smithers that he's in terrible danger from the Spydron, they are going to get rid of you, you know. He's finally sort of had enough and, yeah, just tell him I want my money. Joy then fucks off through a door, ladies first, locks it, apparently. He's hammering on the door. Mavic Chen pops up and has a word with him. After they've had the little conflab, he just turns the key in the door and wanders through it, having threatened Spydron over the microphone, so he had a key the whole time. What was the hammering on the door bit for?
Dramatic tension.
Let me in! Let me in!
Let me in! Oh, I've got a key.
Oops. Shit.
Right at the end, when Sandor and Spydron have double-crossed and triple-crossed and quadruple-crossed each other, and they're both captured, and Steen is there doing his capturing Sandor bit, and she's suddenly gone from one of the most dangerous intergalactic criminals that there is to a petty criminal.
Yes, but isn't that in context? Because Steen gets pulled up by, is it Ginge? He says, well, if that's your example of petty crime, what's your idea of a big crime then? I don't want to find out, Packer.
Bearing in mind that this is the final story of the first series and they want to hook people into coming back for the second series, that whole thing at the end about any child who's alive today could be a tomorrow person, they just need to find the way within themselves to open up their powers. That was a really nice hook to get the audience engaged and involved and going to the schoolyard the next day and playing tomorrow person.
That did leap out to me, actually. I thought that was quite a nice touch. And I'm glad it came from Kevin Stoney rather than Pious John, because it carried some weight coming from a proper actor.
Yes.
Oh, I feel really tight about that, because I know that Nicholas Jung really, he took the part seriously, and it was a big part of his career.
He's was his career.
Well, yeah, but he's always, from what I've seen of him and the interviews I've heard with him, it was always very fondly remembered, and he was very proud of it, and he took it quite seriously. And when he came back for Big Finish, it was pretty much the same feeling. He was not sending it up. He really invested in this part. So I do feel quite bad saying that, but the central cast of The Tomorrow People, my goodness me, they were not chosen for their acting abilities. And guest cast-wise, this is far and away the best guest cast we've seen so far.
So far, yes. When we get on to season three, there's some very good guest cast.
But as a final thought, where do we think that this story stands in the pantheon of Tomorrow People's stories? Is it quite high up or middling or... Because I've got to say that for myself, it's up there. I enjoyed this a lot more than some of the ones we've seen. Bear in mind, I've not seen anywhere near. You've got comprehensive knowledge of these. I do not. I still like The Dirtiest Business. I thought that had a darkness to it. I really quite enjoyed. This, for all the flaws that I've picked in it, I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is a good story rather than a great story. So it's sort of high midpoint.
In terms of Doctor Who, what would we rate it? Pick an equivalent Doctor Who story.
Give me an era. So similar
Tom
era.
Baker.
Colin Baker. No, fuck off.
We'll Tom Baker.
No, we'll do Pertwee because it's similar era.
Okay.
I would say Claws of Axos.
Hmm. See, I always thought you were very fond of that one.
I am very fond of it, but it's not the best story from the era, but it is an above average story from the era.
Hmm. I'll go with that. So on balance, as a noob to The Tomorrow People, really, I am still picking my way through the bones of TP world. I did enjoy it. I would recommend that one to anybody wanting to have a crack at The Tomorrow People. But as a final thought before we check out, it's raising a glass to Peter Vaughan Clark.
Splishy splish.
The Exton Moss experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.